through talking.
No. I want to ask you about, you said the first year, now about the second year on Porcupine Creek. Mm-hmm. Did things get better then?
Well, we sluiced the second year. The first year, we, of course, had no equipment. That was when we... Okay, the first year, we did sluice. We were on... Yankee Creek. And which was one of those innocent kind of mistakes you could make. We thought, well, Big Creek might be harder to handle, so we tried the Pup Creek. That had a good drill line. And we got enough gold to... We didn't pay up everything, but we had a little D4. And we got enough gold to make sure that we paid the fuel bill, and Cape Town got jobs, and Rex Thomas worked for us, and we got him half paid, and then all winter, but he was going to school, and I was working, and Henry had a job, so, and all winter long, he had scholarship subsidy from the Warners that got him through school. And then the year after that, we got an eight. Things were getting better. And then we got hit by the 67 flood. And the eight was buried. And our dam was gone. And our boxes were somewhere. And our cleanup was wherever all that was. I was in town, Henry and I were in town because of my thesis. I was defending my thesis when the flood hit. And we had a caretaker at camp who didn't really realize how fast a creek could come up. And by the time he realized the creek was what we had talked about, like moving the cat or something, if the water came up while we were gone, the August rains hit, he sat in the cookhouse and watched the rain. Nobody was, well, that August flood was absolutely, it was a 100-year flood. I'm not suggesting he should have tied a rope on and tried to swim the creek, he'd have been killed. But so much for a caretaker that doesn't believe you need to move things.
It's a setback.
Oh, that was a huge setback. But we dug it out the next year. Jack Neubauer went up and helped because he was an old timer that knew how to do things like that. I think we sent him up there to give us a hand, obviously. And we found the boxes. Fortunately, they put steel boxes, big steel boxes. And we didn't get much done in 69, but by 70 we were ready to give it another effort. And of course, R&M Engineering was doing a lot of design for the pipeline, and Henry took that engineering experience he had from Lawrence Radiation Labs and worked for R&M all winter long doing thermocouples and stuff up and down the line. And I went to work for R&M. Setting up their, computerizing their lab information and stuff like that. And we saved money to go back. Those first years were kind of hit and miss. Sometimes you had to work and get enough money to pay the fuel bill before you could go. Mm-hmm. We never went, we couldn't do anything if we didn't have 8,000 at least to open the door. I mean, you just had to have startup money. That's all there was to it. And there were people coming out then, a little bit. Bill Ackles was coming into the thing. Freddie was there. George Seufert and Ken Manning were trying over on Eagle Creek. There was Brentwood had definitely loosened up the idea that the price of gold could rise. And as Freddie said, all of us got optimistic whenever it took a big jump, like the time it went to $109. Freddie bought something, and then it fell back to about 70, and he had the pleasure of paying for it with $70 gold. And things were heating up out toward Livingston and other areas, too. We'll see the guys could work the slope in the winter and make big money, and then go out and develop their passion to go mining. The romance of gold's always been there. And almost everybody I know would rather work for himself than work for the other guy.
Yeah.
And there was this idea that you could do it. Other people had made money mining in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, the roads were getting better, trucks were better, the equipment was more available. Classroom was fun. I could remember the Circle Mining District picnics. Awesome. I was looking at some pictures of one of them the other day. I mean, we had the water fight with the state when they came in with the regulations starting in about 84, when the miners formed their advocacy council, and statewide we formed. Miners Advocacy Council raised money and took on the EPA and DEC water rates. We didn't win. It was one of those lessons in practicality. Government has to do the pro forma, but it doesn't have to get the right answer. You can go to a hearing with 201 people there, and 198 of them can testify on one side, and three people could testify on the other, and the government could say the three people were more influential.
Right.
They don't have to live. They have to listen, but they don't have to hear.
Was this the recycling of all the makeup water?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, part of the objection for many of us was that a whole bunch of the science was based on sex fish. Jackie LaPerriere's PhD thesis, which I do not think should have stood. Personally, don't you dare put this in a book. Personally, I do not think that thesis should ever have stood up to peer review. I don't think it ever was subjected to peer review. It was a politically correct study, carefully designed so that it couldn't fail. And unfortunately, I'm outspoken at times, and I said so.
Yeah. No, I'm not going into the controversy over this.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't think so. But it was a point of unity statewide for a certain group of miners. The placer miners were very upset with the Miners Association because the Miners Association was doing all the big guys. They were doing things for Misty Fjord, for Red Dog, down at
Juno, probably.
Oh, Juno, but not only that, Greens Creek.
Yeah.
And then the place where they had the platinum.
Oh, good news.
But there was somebody that was very active in the Miners Association that had the dredge there or something. And they were fiddling around looking for platinum hard rock. And I think the rest of us, if we weren't players at the level that could do that, the placer miners decided they weren't getting equal representation.
Yeah.
So they, but it was amazing that a group of independents strung out from all these creeks all over the state could get organized, incorporate, get a set of directors, and fund a suit against the DEC. For the way they were implementing the EPA requirements. What was it? Mm-hmm.
Did you have a a pond and everything set up?
We did the 401. They had it. They finally did a project through DEC, and it was a joint venture project with DEC, EPA, and the Warners. Not because we were really hot to do this, but they couldn't find anybody who would cooperate. And we had a big enough place to cooperate because we had 56 claims. And they also had a kind of a stranglehold, but both Henry and I had reputations for academia to an extent. And I was working in the environmental section of DOT. I mean, you know, it was pretty hard not to cooperate. We didn't make any money of it. I mean, it was funded, but Henry and I did not take a penny. No.
So what did you do?
They used our property, and then the benefit that we had of it was we had the pond when they were done. Larry Peterson was big on that.
Right.
I think we, at one time they needed our tractor. We had a D9. And they got our tractor and Richard at cost to do a couple of things.
So you had a good operation, I mean.
Oh no, we were not.
Yeah.
We weren't the biggest, but we, and we weren't the worst. We certainly we had our share of Uncle Billy whiz bangs too. Not as many as others. I mean, there's a lot of stories on the creek about things, great ideas that didn't quite work, or something that got put together and that didn't, you know, just that wasn't our reputation. We weren't the best. We either didn't have the best ground or we weren't the best miners. Our biggest problem was we never had had enough money, and this is a common business problem, to get everything all at once so it was balanced. So we would have a big sluice box and a little kitty, or a big kitty and a little shaker screen, but there was always some bottleneck somewhere giving a little bit of flow. And Doug Holt was such a brilliant man. He came out and consulted to us a couple times. And we talked about, and Henry believed this thoroughly, fortunately, the only time you may not make your money sluicing. You're not going to get any if you don't sluice. But actually, if you look at your dollars per yard, if you could strip very, very, very efficiently, even if it cost you, say you could strip 75,000 yards very cheaply, but it cost you, let's put a number on it, you can strip it for, in those days, probably a buck a yard. We'll say that. Well, it was cheap then. But it cost you sluicing and all that stuff. Might cost you $6 a yard. So every yard you sluice cost you money, except that when it was averaged out and all the yards were worth $5, and if you were sluicing a stripping a 5-to-1 ratio, you had to sluice to get the money. But that's when you made money stripping. You were actually losing money sluicing. Well, like everybody else, we had our you know, we were thin on equipment. We didn't have a lot of backup. And the whole thing is, it's a Circle District for everybody was a dirt show. And you had to, one, know how to move dirt, and then two, you had to keep your uptime. A downtime day was just, it was a downtime day. It cost as much as any other day. But it didn't produce anything. And there are still miners out there. This is a little touch you'll appreciate. We always valued our ground in terms of dollars per yard. And then took the stripping ratio into account. But the Underwood boys and a couple of others I know evaluate their ground based on how many ounces per hour they're getting in their sluice box. So if they sluice 17 hours, they want to know how much they got per hour, which is a very different concept. But I knew people who were great dirt movers, like would work for Green or a road type. And they were not good placer miners. It absolutely bugged them to slow down. I mean, they wanted to hot rod through the sluice, through the recovery process. And I haven't seen many recovery processes that you can hot rod through. I mean, you've got to know what rock you're washing. You've got to know what expected heads were, and when you figure out what you got, and if it doesn't kind of compare favorably with what you thought the heads were, you better go look at every place you had a discharge and see where you put it.
Because it was running through the sluice.
It either went through the sluice, or when you got rid of the big rocks, they were thoroughly washed, or, I mean, you really had to, if you didn't get basically what you thought you should get, you better look around and see if it went somewhere, or if you just had made an erroneous prediction.
Oh, well, those are really great thoughts. Doug Culp was so good, too, about that. Very practical.
Oh, I loved it, Doug. I mean, he absolutely was, he was practical, and he had done the mining, and he'd done it under circumstances where it wasn't, when it was $35 gold, he'd had a dredge sink.
Right.
And he'd had to recover from some setbacks. But he knew he'd run. He ran part of Usabella at one time. That was, they said when he was down there, he was tough. If he didn't like the way a guy got on the tractor, he fired him on the spot. And I know, I think he worked when they tried to revive the Bartholomew. I think he did some consulting on that. Way back when it was St. Joe Minerals.
Quite a
Well, Earl Pilgrim, the name that I couldn't remember from Cantishna.
Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah.
I kept saying it, P.
Yes.
It was Earl Pilgrim,
okay.
Who was out in Circle, had staked the one hard rock claim that was staked out there prior to the 80s.
So let's go into the hard rock. Let's go now into the excitement of the Tintina trend.
Boy, isn't that better gold?
Yeah.
And if you look, the history to that role a little bit. The earlier portion of it, before it really got hit. First of all, the Canadians are the ones that really nailed it.
Yes, yes.
But, well, they nailed it and started on it. I think we had people that were sniffing it. Well, we got Fort Knox. And when you stop to think when that timeline on that one was, but that was, in some ways, a no-brainer, because everybody's been kicking on that hill for years. It was close to town. The students could go out there. Earl Beislein loved to take them up, and they'd do a line, and they'd do this. And there was some placer production, and there had been some high-grade gold production.
Right.
But this, like so many other places, there had nobody seen enough to make a pogo-type mine. They didn't have a high-grade mine that was going to get big.
Right.
I think the biggest had been McCarthy, wasn't it? Or
Christina?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Vedder Lode.
Yeah.
What's interesting, no one had tied down where the gold came from.
Right.
There were so many theories.
Yeah.
And finally, Fort Knox proved it.
But they didn't know at first. But I remember Paul Metz and the Fairbanks sequence. Remember when they started talking about it being stacked?
Right.
I'll just let it go.
Okay. But the Fairbanks sequence, yeah.
And all of a sudden we were getting papers in Fairbanks about hard rock, and two other huge scientific players in the background that were really pushing along with this. Bob Forbes was encouraging Milt Wiltse big time to, you know, go along with those things, and then Milt, of course, succeeded Bob. And then we started having the Reiner.
I think he was the big influence.
Oh yeah, he brought the ideas from Stanford. Just new blood to that. John Simms was big on all of this.
Hmm.
And he had consulted all over the world. And he's the one who recruited Reiner.
So they finally figured out that it was the intrusive.
But Tom Bunsen has been.
True.
A very much quieter.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't that so much as he was farther down the list in age, so he was a little down the list on pecking order, and he wanted to retire because so many of the men in his family have died young.
Oh.
And he wanted to quit before, around the time he was 50, he was ready to step down. He told me that he wanted to be sure he had a life, too.
Yeah.
But it wasn't because he couldn't get along with Milt or anything like that. And you see John Gailey coming back into the country, Bob Morrell. See, they all did some hard rock stuff out in Central. They were at Circle, too. After they did Fort Knox, they went to Circle. And you had Lonnie Heiner and Jack DeMarkey, you know, Resource Associates. They struck up, let's see, we were still living in the Wolf House, so they had to be formed in the 60s. We don't think of that then. You know, there was a really active academic world here that was making the lay of the track for this hard rock show. You know, the North Commission. We had governors like Hickel that were resource development oriented. Our oil business was paying off for the state finally. There were dollars.
And the state had started selecting all of these great lands.
Yes. And these people had, when they were helping, well, that was one of the reasons for a lot of these recon reports that were...
Right. Resource Associates and others. Nuclear.
Oh, yes. And then, of course, the native corporations were getting their lands, and it was the Harry Noyes. It was definitely a huge resource for Doyon.
Mm.
He came from Illinois, I think.
Mm.
Professor Noyes.
Mm.
He was in the John Simms Reiner class.
Uh-huh. Well, anyway, let's go back to what's happening though in the same in terms of like.
Okay, the, now so, we yeah. are seeing the results of all this research and some successes, coupled with the fact that Canada, you know, the concept of a continuum up the entire trench, and the theories that go down with the remobilization of gold and John Antweiler and Jack Antweiler and John Castro from USGS were out here in the 80s again, testing crystalline gold and gold, how it came up over in Manly. And then Circle, they were looking, all of a sudden people were looking at, are these big, huge caldera type things, or is it the fault? And they're pretty much now on the Tintina Belt. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone's landed on the idea that that's, exactly. And there's other, there may be circular features along the belt, or that have been, you know, whacked in half by the belt. Okay. But which is like way back to Jim Barker's. Mm-hmm. Let's just move it and slide it, yep. And look what you get. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we're seeing some proactive development. They're looking openly for large deposits. They're willing to accept large deposits of lower grade. But this is also not just because the belt is there, but because the metallurgy and recovery techniques for handling that particular kind of deposit. The chemists and the geologists have been finding it, and the chemists have been figuring out how to recover it.
And it's a lot easier without all the sulfites not there.
Oh, isn't that awesome when that happens?
Yeah.
It doesn't always happen. But then now they're finding, like, I understand, up at Donlin. Mm-hmm. Isn't Donlin the one that has the awful sulfite problem?
I think that's alive and good in the Money Knob.
No, it was the before. Bob Morrell called it the most unfriendly ore he ever saw. Mm. They had a lot of gold.
Oh, it could be the Golden Horn?
What's it? North.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, there's Pebble, there's Donlin. And
oh, Donlin up there at Southwest Europe. That's huge, but it's very, very low grade. Yeah.
Oh, this other one is high. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking of it by Nome somewhere. Well, it's like the Earl Pilgrim. Maybe the name will come to me.
Rock Creek.
Anyway, again, the story there is the sulfides were just killing it. There was nothing. They couldn't bring in enough limestone to develop it.
Right.
I think it was a Rick Van Nieuwenhuis project. Anyway, they've now broken the back of that. They're going to be able to develop it because mm-hmm. they found some other way to be. They don't have to mine four times as much limestone as they mine ore in order to get a recovery. I heard that project will be a go now. Mm. So the metallurgists and the geologists and Mother Nature got to play, each one's got to play their hand.
Yeah.
I'm really, really happy about what's going on out in the circle of central, my area, because years ago, the USGS had a report out, because what's it, the 30s? And the comment was made that there would never be a hard rock camp there, because all there were little stringers of gold, but there was nothing, you know, compact and mineable. No evidence of a favorable geology for compact and mineable. And people for a long time, I think that might be why people didn't look for a long time. You could get a rich sample piece of load, but you couldn't find any place where to go with it.
Right.
But now, let's see how the development out there started. I have a lot of claims now, part of the country at times, like about 700 of them, off and on. NERCO did a recon in 87, 88, that included Table Mountain. It was their interior regional recon, and it was a joint venture with Western Australia and Resource Associates. I don't think they were NERCO yet. Well, said, yeah, the paper, the drafting says NERCO, so they were NERCO by then, and the work was done by Resource. Because I've got copies of that. I located two of the projects when they got them. Okay, so they were out there. There was a little sniffing. We had staked some stake claims. Actually, in I believe it was 84, we covered our federal placer claims with state claims to preserve the hard rock, to keep a hard rock company from coming in and going over us. The state had selected the ground so you could no longer stake a federal hard rock claim, even over your own federal placer. So we had to put a state claim over it. Mm-hmm. So we had hard rock, I mean, they were hard rock claims, but not because we found hard rock. They were hard rock claims to keep the hard rockers out of there. I was afraid. I had seen some location reports, notices, and there was a statement on them that was a little bit intimidating. It's would they go right over you and then say, subject to valid existing rights. That sounded like a nice validity challenge, which we would never be able to afford as individuals, with a federal agency as to whether our claims were valid. Yeah, that did not send me. That's why we were out staking. But we weren't the only one. What else was going on for hard rock? See, remember, you're seeing it starting in the 80s there, mid-80s. Paul Metz had the geologic camp out there and decided that he had spotted something called the Bonanza Sequence. Rudy Vetter was staking the Joker. And who else was? I mean, people were trying to find hard rock, but nobody had found any yet. John Mitchell and I were staking. We had 3,000 acres in before John died, and we were staking hard rock down in the Alaska Range, Henry and I, in 87. So it was coming.
So tell me about how it started, though, with your situation. You had a cat.